to me. Yet while both the revenue share and guarantee were highly aggressive, Google's improved AdWords algorithms made the deal highly profitable for both parties. And the move allowed Google to increase its revenues from roughly $19 million pre-AOL in 2001 to $347 million post-AOL in 2003, a nearly 20-fold jump. No one truly knows whether the markets will go up or down in any particular year, but regardless of which direction they move, blitzscaling can be a key strategy for capitalizing on the biggest opportunities. Going faster. Once you decide to blitzscale, the key question you need to ask and answer is, how can we move faster? This isn't simply a matter of working harder or smarter with the same resources. It's doing things that other companies normally don't do, or choosing not to do things that they do because you're willing to tolerate greater uncertainty or lesser efficiency. For example, in 2015, Payal Kadakia, the founder of ClassPass, a monthly subscription service for fitness classes, decided that she needed to double the size of her staff in just 3 months so that ClassPass would be able to expand into more cities. To achieve this kind of speed, Kadakia and her team abandoned traditional hiring processes and followed two simple rules. First, they hired people from their personal networks with an emphasis on branded talent. For example, if an employee had a friend and that friend worked for the management consulting firm Bain & Company, that friend got hired because ClassPass could assume that the person was smart and would get along with people. Second, some of the time saved by not interviewing for skills allowed the team to interview for alignment with the company's mission. Crazy? Perhaps. But ClassPass was in a crowded, emerging market, and being able to hire faster than the competition helped it maintain and increase its leadership position. Blitzscaling also requires a strong focus on risk management. While blitzscaling requires risk-taking, it doesn't require unnecessary risk-taking. Indeed, the higher level of risk associated with blitzscaling makes risk management even more valuable and important. As Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang told us in an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, all bold strategies have a risk. If you don't see it, you're flying risk blind. A final word of caution. Just because you can blitzscale doesn't mean that you should. Throwing out the rules of business doesn't guarantee success any more than following the rules does. In the early days of LinkedIn, we knew that achieving a critical mass of users was going to be a challenge. We had to do a lot of education to get professionals to understand our value proposition. Most didn't realize the power of their networks and how technology could help them enhance, extend, and leverage them better. One approach, which quite a number of people recommended we follow, was to raise a large amount of venture capital and embark on an aggressive advertising campaign to accelerate user growth. This would be a classic example of blitzscaling, sacrificing efficiency for growth against a backdrop of uncertainty. But we decided against this strategy. We believed that the competition wasn't as urgent as many thought, and keeping our burn rate lower would allow us to wait for the market to catch up to our point of view. As we pursued our slow and steady startup growth strategy, the people who recommended investing in inefficient growth warned us that our competitors would leave us behind. We weren't worried, since our reading of the market was that competitors like Plaxo didn't truly understand the power of a professional social network. Instead, they were treating their product like an address book, and thus weren't competing for the same market. This hypothesis ended up being proven by later events. If taking on additional costs and uncertainty doesn't actually confer an advantage, it's better to follow the traditional rules of business, at least for the time being, so that when blitzscaling does become appropriate, your organization can be efficient, well-maintained, and more ready to scale. When LinkedIn finally did identify the opportunity to grow a major business by selling an enterprise product to recruiters, we were a more mature company that could blitzscale with confidence in our ability to make these judgment calls. When should I stop blitzscaling? While blitzscaling is a powerful strategy, it is not a permanent one. No business can grow forever simply because no market is infinite. You blitzscale when your market is big or growing fast, or preferably both. If your market stops growing or reaches its upper limit, you should stop blitzscaling. Because blitzscaling is, by definition, an inefficient use of capital, it only makes sense when speed and momentum are important. Blitzscaling is like the afterburners on a fighter jet that allow you to fly at double or triple normal speed but consume fuel at a shockingly high rate. You don't just switch on the afterburners and never turn them off. One of the major challenges of blitzscaling is knowing when your business is outgrowing your current strategy and when you need to change course. It's unwise to wait until you stop growing to make the transition. Instead, you should pay attention to some of the leading indicators that could act as an early warning sign that you've outgrown your strategy. Declining rate of growth relative to the market and competition. Worsening unit economics. Decreasing per employee productivity. Increasing management overhead. When these leading indicators begin to appear, it is probably a sign that your current strategy won't scale further, and it's time to begin the cycle anew. For example, Yahoo was able to ride its core strategy of being the leading online media company for a decade, with revenues growing briskly, albeit with a downdraft during the dot-com bust, through 2005. At that point, however, Yahoo's revenues stopped growing, and indeed began to decline in 2007, even before the global recession hit. Google had just passed Yahoo in annual revenues in 2005, $6.1 billion for Google, $5.3 billion for Yahoo, and after that, the fates of the companies diverged dramatically. Yahoo's revenue was roughly flat in 2006, while Google's nearly doubled again. Blitzscaling can actually be dangerous when you reach the limits of your market. If you run out of market headroom, all that speed and momentum will come to a crashing halt as you slam into your market's ceiling. The usual symptom of running out of headroom, besides a sudden slowdown in growth, is internal conflict. Managers and investors who have gotten used to continuing growth start asking questions like, what went wrong, and who's responsible? If the company doesn't realize the root cause, the most common and unhelpful response is to call for changing the CEO or the executive team. The VP of sales is particularly vulnerable because he or she often takes the blame for the slowdown, or both. How many times does replacing the CEO actually reignite massive growth? The only good example we can think of is what Steve Jobs did at Apple. So, if you have a Steve Jobs waiting in the wings, go ahead and switch CEOs. Otherwise, it probably won't help. Consider what happened to two blitzscalers who ran out of headroom, Groupon and Twitter. Groupon was one of the fastest growing companies of all time, thanks to its leadership position in the rapidly emerging daily deals market. Unfortunately, the daily deals market suddenly stopped growing. The problem was actually an ironic echo of bad blitzscaling. Groupon merchants used Groupon's daily deals as an inefficient way to generate rapid revenue growth, only to discover that the promotions didn't lead to repeat business or any other long-term competitive advantage or value. Groupon began suffering from internal turmoil, and sure enough, Andrew Mason was replaced as CEO. It didn't help. What Groupon should have done is to stop blitzscaling. The pursuit of inefficient growth was overheating the market and making it unsustainable. If Groupon had reduced the discounts it required of merchants, growth would have declined, but the business generated by those smaller discounts would have been more sustainable. Twitter ran into a similar problem. At the end of 2014, its user growth slowed to a crawl. This was the signal for Twitter to ease off the gas and focus on efficiency. In the period from 2011 to 2014, Twitter had increased its employee base by more than a factor of 10, anticipating continued growth. Twitter continued to hire in 2015, adding nearly 300 employees despite the lack of user growth. Twitter may have been head-faked because revenue continued to grow as the advertising market matured. Revenues more than doubled over the course of 2015, then stopped growing. Twitter is beginning to shrink its number of employees today, but probably should have been even more aggressive in doing so once it became apparent that its blitzscaling period was over. Naturally, it was during this period that Twitter decided to change CEOs again, with Dick Costolo, who had replaced founder Ev Williams, departing, and Jack Dorsey assuming the role of interim CEO. Both Costolo and Dorsey are incredibly talented executives, but even great talent can't blitzscale in a market that has hit its ceiling. Can I choose not to blitzscale? First, as we've discussed, blitzscaling is not for everyone. For example, in 1994, the same year that Jeff Bezos founded Amazon, the restaurateur Thomas Keller bought the French Laundry in Yountville, California, and turned it into one of the world's greatest restaurants, winning a coveted 3-star rating from the Michelin Guide. Today, Amazon has over 541,900 employees and is the market leader in online retail, e-books, cloud computing, and more, while the French Laundry, with less than 50 staff members, in a single location, serving just 60 customers per day, is still one of the world's most famous restaurants. Both Amazon and the French Laundry are great businesses, but they exist in fundamentally different worlds. Amazon's business relies on massive scale and billions of dollars of infrastructure. The French Laundry relies on local ingredients of the highest quality prepared by some of the most skilled cooks in the world. Scale is critical to e-commerce and cloud computing. Scale is antithetical to world-class fine dining. It is as impossible to imagine Amazon as a small independent bookstore as it is to imagine the French Laundry as a global restaurant chain vying with McDonald's for franchise supremacy. But if the conditions are ripe for blitzscaling, competitors may choose to take on the risks you're reluctant to assume in exchange for a chance at reaping the potential rewards. That's what Airbnb learned when Wimdu entered its market. Blitzscaling requires capital, whether from investors or from cash flow, to fund relatively inefficient growth. If investors are willing to act quickly and provide large amounts of capital, the risk that a competitor decides to blitzscale is higher. The same is true when a business model provides a lot of high-margin revenue to fund growth. So the safest time to choose not to blitzscale is when you're pursuing a relatively low-margin business model that investors are unwilling to fund at all, unwilling to fund at scale, or unwilling to fund quickly. Like, say, a fine dining restaurant. Many small or lifestyle businesses fall into this category, which makes their decision to avoid blitzscaling perfectly rational. However, markets can change quickly. Let's return to 1994 and the founding of Amazon. For many years, independent bookstores had carved out a market niche by positioning themselves relative to competition from chain stores such as Barnes & Noble and Borders. The rise of Amazon and its pursuit of a blitzscaling strategy significantly changed the competitive landscape for those bookstores, forcing them to respond. In 1994, the American Booksellers Association had over 8,000 members. By 2009, that number had declined to 1,651, down nearly 80%. Shockingly, that number has grown every year since 2009, rebounding to 2,321 in 2017. We'll delve more into how independent bookstores managed to survive in the age of Amazon when we examine how to defend your business against blitzscaling competitors. Even if you don't face such a competitor, blitzscaling still makes major waves that can impact your business. Here in Silicon Valley, blitzscaling has caused higher property values, a higher cost of living, and a tight labor market that has affected nearly every business within its boundaries, regardless of industry. Even if you don't compete with blitzscalers for customers, you probably compete with them for office space and employees. Blitzscaling is iterative. Successful blitzscaling is an exercise in serial problem solving. Each of the five stages requires different solutions to the same basic problems of people, product, finance, and so on. Each time you manage to solve a problem, the problem is never solved forever. It's only solved for now. As the company continues to grow, you have to solve the same problem again, under a new and potentially radical different set of circumstances. In 2013, Paul Graham, the co-founder of Y Combinator, wrote a famous essay titled Do Things That Don't Scale, in which he argues that startups are like old-fashioned cars with engine cranks. To get them started, founders need to engage in a separate and laborious process that couldn't possibly work at scale, such as personally recruiting a product's first users. This essay is a classic, but it may give some listeners the mistaken impression that once the engine starts, all you need to do is keep doing things that scale. In other words, the conventional and erroneous wisdom says, Step 1. Do things that don't scale. Step 2. Achieve scale. Step 3. Do things that scale. But when you're blitzscaling, the things you do to help you scale up to the next stage probably won't allow you to scale up to the stage after that. To build a true scale-up, almost everything you do has to change with each stage. Blitzscaling extends the simple 3-step process of do things that don't scale as follows. Step 1. Do things that don't scale. Step 2. Reach the next stage of blitzscaling. Step 3. Figure out how to do one set of things that scale, while somehow also finding a way to do a completely different set of things that don't scale. Step 4. Reach the next stage of blitzscaling. Step 5. Repeat over and over until you reach complete market dominance. This doesn't mean that you don't need to plan ahead, although you will often need to do things that don't scale. At the same time, you'll have to make choices that permit the possibility, though not the certainty, of massive scale. For example, if your core business model lacks scale advantages and network effects, and the only possible go-to-market strategy consists of door-to-door sales, it's unlikely that you'll ever be able to build a massively important business, whether or not you attempt to blitzscale. How blitzscaling strategy changes in each stage. As we saw in our discussion of blitzscaling in different economic environments, speed is always relative. What represents hypergrowth speed at one stage might be only average during another. For example, nearly every startup tries to move quickly. This means that during the family and tribe stages of blitzscaling, up to 100 employees, it can be challenging to move at a speed that is clearly faster than the average startup. There are only three ways to accomplish this. First, you might be the only competent player in your market space. This is extremely rare because any attractive market space tends to draw in smart, aggressive entrepreneurs. Second, you might be the first player in your market to have figured out a brilliant growth strategy. Wonderful if you can manage it, but also somewhat rare. For example, PayPal wasn't the only payment startup trying to attack the market, but it was the first to tap into viral marketing for extremely rapid and cost-effective user acquisition. Third, you can distinguish yourself from your peers by pursuing scale more resolutely. Startups that assume success and make commitments and investments accordingly can get a jump on their rivals, provided the market plays out as they anticipate. This kind of confidence manifests itself in being more aggressive about fundraising, hiring, and infrastructure investment, incurring current expenses that hopefully will allow your company to move much faster in the future. Throughout its history, Amazon has been more aggressive than its competitors, and that aggressiveness has paid huge dividends. Of course, it helps that Jeff Bezos and his team are world-class at executing against this strategy. The downside, of course, is that the cost of failure is much higher than if you proceeded with deliberate caution and waited for proof before making commitments. But this additional cost can be dwarfed by the potential benefits of achieving first scalar advantage in a valuable winner-take-most or winner-take-all market. At the village, hundreds of employees, and city, thousands of employees, stages, the speeds of competing organizations become much more varied. Some will be content with focusing on optimizing for efficiency, scale-up growth, while others will focus on speed, fast scaling, or speed in the face of uncertainty, blitzscaling. At this stage, blitzscaling is less about raw aggression and more about pursuing a differentiated, but still aggressive, strategy. For example, one of the signature strategies for blitzscaling is rapid parallel market development. When Airbnb made the decision to blitzscale, its chosen strategy was to rapidly expand from a single office in the United States to a score of offices around the world, especially in Europe. This kind of growth is highly inefficient. Think of all the new knowledge and infrastructure and personnel an organization has to acquire to successfully open offices around the world, but it can allow a company to stand out from its competitors. It would have been more efficient for Airbnb to expand one country and one office at a time, refining its approach based on the lessons of each rollout, but that would have allowed its competitor Wimdu to be the faster mover. In other words, when it needed to grow from a 40-person company to a global company in a single year, Airbnb couldn't afford to be cautious with its capital and focus on efficiency. We'll see this pattern of simultaneous market development in later examples and across multiple industries. At the nation stage, tens of thousands of employees, the strategy shifts again. Companies get to massive scale by dominating an industry until they become mature and mainstream. As described in Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, nation stage companies have succeeded in crossing the chasm between a customer base of early adopters and Main Street. Market dominance makes it difficult to grow much faster than the overall market, while market maturity reduces the number of opportunities for organic growth. As a result, scaling at this stage is about incubating and growing a major new business. In 2007, Apple had over 20,000 employees, was the dominant company in the online music business, and was a successful player in the personal computer business. Meanwhile, Google had over 10,000 employees and was the dominant company in search. Nokia, the dominant mobile phone handset maker, had over 70,000 employees. These nation-stage companies were all starting out with roughly the same share of the market for the newfangled smartphones. In 2007, Apple introduced the iPhone and Google introduced the Android operating system. 3 years later, they dominated the mobile phone market while Nokia was in disarray, eventually selling its handset business to Microsoft in 2013. The ability to blitzscale new businesses in a new market is what separated Apple and Google from Nokia, and it's what has powered their ascent to the number one and number two most valuable companies in the world as of 2017. How the role of the founder changes in each stage. The role a founder plays in the blitzscaling process changes in each stage, and an employee's role relative to the founder will likely also change. As the organization grows, the specific skills required to lead it evolve as well. Stage 1. Family. The founder personally pulls the levers of hypergrowth. In the very early days of a company, a founder has to do everything, including implementing the techniques of blitzscaling. For example, if your business relies on viral marketing for distribution, you will probably do everything from writing the copy for the invitation emails to segmenting the data on open and conversion rates. Stage 2. Tribe. The founder manages the people who are pulling the levers. As the organization grows, a founder probably starts to manage a team of employees. Even if you retain some individual responsibilities, the bulk of your value creation comes from working with the team members and helping them be more productive. For example, if you now run the engineering team, you might still be doing some work to maintain the earlier code you wrote, but your focus should be on managing the other engineers and letting them build new features. Stage 3. Village. The founder designs an organization that pulls the levers. The village stage transition can be difficult for you as a founder because it is at this phase that it becomes harder to see the immediate impact of your work. While you might know and interact with frontline employees, you're not likely to be their direct manager anymore. Now you need to take a big picture view and focus on designing the organization. Founders who don't find this interesting or appealing may choose to remain individual contributors or team managers. This is also the stage at which organizations hire executives from the outside. We'll discuss this further in the next part. Stage 4. City. The founder makes high-level decisions about goals and strategies. When the company reaches the city stage, the founder's role is to make the big strategic decisions. These decisions may very well have tactical implications, but now it's someone else's job to work those out. At Facebook, one of the key high-level decisions that Mark Zuckerberg made was to halt new feature development for nearly 2 years to focus on Facebook's mobile product. When he made this gutsy decision in early 2012, Facebook was deep into the city stage with over 4,000 employees. He didn't personally hire the developers who joined the mobile team or design the new mobile app, but he made the tough call, then held accountable those who were pulling the levers directly. Stage 5. Nation. The founder figures out how to pull the organization back from blitzscaling and start blitzscaling new product lines and business units. Even though managing a nation-stage company has some things in common with managing a traditional business, it's critical to keep blitzscaling even as you implement some traditional management practices. When Steve Jobs returned to Apple, for example, he both focused on traditional measures of operational effectiveness and invested in building new, insanely great products. On the traditional management side, he slashed inventories and improved Apple's financial management, but he also launched major new products such as the iPod, iTunes, the iPhone, and the iPad. From strategy to management. When a company is blitzscaling, the constant doubling or even tripling of its size makes it difficult to apply traditional management techniques designed for environments in which 15% represents brisk annual growth. As a result, successful blitzscalers have to implement management innovations to steer their burgeoning organizations through their growing pains. The upcoming sections will discuss how. Part 4. Management Innovation. One of the key features that sets global giants apart from those companies that flame out or implode before they can reach market dominance is an ability to evolve and optimize their management practices at each stage of growth. The proven techniques we'll describe in this part fall into two main categories: 8 key transitions, which help guide the company through the stages of blitzscaling, and 9 counterintuitive rules, which turn the conventional wisdom of traditional management on its head in order to cope with blitzscaling's frenzied pace of growth. Whether you're at the helm of a company, run a specific division, or lead a smaller team, each of the following techniques can offer you guidance on how to manage growth as your organization progresses from startup to scale up. 8 key transitions. Transition number 1. Small teams to large teams. The first and most obvious management challenge for blitzscaling organizations to navigate is the shift from small teams to large teams. Even if a rapidly growing company tries to organize itself as a collection of small teams, it still requires a very different approach to pursue its corporate goals and initiatives. Nor is growth simply a matter of turning a crank. Every aspect of people management, from recruiting to coaching to communications, has to adapt to the different stages of blitzscaling. Small teams, which are especially common in the family and tribe stages of blitzscaling, can operate spontaneously and informally, thanks to the personal relationships and frequent contact between team members. This flexibility allows these teams to be extremely adaptable and to change directions quickly as the company learns new information and has to adjust its strategy and tactics. During the family and tribe stages of PayPal, having a small, nimble team allowed us to execute 4 hard pivots during the first year of the company's existence. When Peter Thiel, Max Levchin, and Luke Nosek founded PayPal, then known as Confinity, in December 1998, Confinity was intended to be a mobile phone encryption company using Max's highly efficient encryption technology. From there, the company pivoted first to mobile phone cash, pivot number 1, and then to Palm Pilot payments via infrared beaming, pivot number 2. Unfortunately, the network of Palm Pilot users who wanted to beam money to each other simply wasn't that robust, so we pivoted again and added email payments, pivot number 3. By the end of the year, we saw an emerging market in settling eBay transactions and pivoted our product development efforts to serve that market, pivot number 4. In just 12 months, we had launched a company, built a product, and pivoted 4 times. This was possible only because between 8 and 40 people worked for the company when each of the pivots took place, allowing us to easily shift the entire business focus and tactics quickly with each pivot. As the business grows into the village stage and beyond, its organization necessarily includes larger teams, such as departments with tens of employees, often dispersed across various offices and places. These larger teams cannot operate spontaneously and informally. An individual employee might only see certain team members a few times a year, if ever. Coordinating the efforts of tens or hundreds of individuals and ensuring alignment with the goals of the entire organization as a whole requires planning and formal processes, often to the chagrin of an idealistic founder more interested in long-term vision than the minutiae of day-to-day management. Wendy Kopp, the founder of Teach for America, learned this lesson the hard way. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, she told us, "I started out 28 years ago with a total disdain for organizational matters. I just thought everyone who comes to this should be mission-driven, and we're not going to have any hierarchy, and we're going to pay everyone the same thing. About 5 years into this, I realized that if I didn't become obsessed with the very mundane matter of how to manage effectively, we'd never get there." Yet beyond simple organizational logistics, one of the major challenges that leaders of blitzscaling organizations need to overcome is the psychological effect that this transition has on early employees and even founders. At the family stage, it's often the case that every member of the team is involved in every major decision. At the village stage and beyond, this is nearly impossible. Employees are busy enough simply keeping up with the activities of their immediate team or area. The operations of other departments are largely a mystery. For new employees, this state of affairs will seem normal, but for early employees, this shift can be disconcerting, leaving them feeling like they used to be insiders, but are now treated like outsiders. The answer is not to involve those employees in every decision. That would be inappropriate and logistically impossible. Rather, create other systems to help them feel connected to the company's mission. For example, the Alliance outlines how tours of duty keep employees engaged. Visit AlliedTalent.com for more information and resources. You're also adding qualitatively different kinds of people to the team. One metaphor I use to explain this shift is to take yet another analogy from military history. The Marines take the beach, the Army takes the country, and the police govern the country. Marines are startup people who are used to dealing with chaos and improvising solutions on the spot. Army soldiers are scale-up people who know how to rapidly seize and secure territory once your forces make it off the beach. And police officers are stability people whose job is to sustain rather than disrupt. The Marines and the Army can usually work together, and the Army and the police can usually work together, but the Marines and the police rarely work well together. As you blitzscale, you may need to find new beaches for your Marines to take rather than asking them to help patrol the existing ones. The expansion of the organization may also create issues around career expectations. One of the topics we'll discuss later is the need to swap in key executives as the company grows. Most people have skills and experiences that optimize them for a particular stage, and not every person can effectively grow in lockstep with the company. Simon Rothman saw this firsthand when he was helping eBay to blitzscale. "People have elastic limits," he told us. "Of the first 100 people, only a few scaled to a 10,000-person organization. It was hard to predict who would scale. People who were smarter than me didn't always scale." Here in Silicon Valley, it's quite common for an executive to specialize in getting a company from $0 to $1 million, and for another to specialize in getting it from $1 million to $10 million. This can cause frustration among early employees, especially if they were leading a specific function and now an outside executive is being hired above them to be their boss. That's why it's important to set correct expectations up front. Be clear that employees will get opportunities to grow and advance their careers, but this doesn't necessarily mean that if they're running engineering now, they'll be VP of engineering when the company has 10,000 employees and is planning its IPO. Focus on responsibility instead of the specific title. An employee who runs the engineering department at the family stage might consider a demotion to be one of several directors of engineering at the city or nation stage, but you can point out that at the family stage, she was managing a team of 3 engineers, and now she oversees a team of 100. Encourage employees to focus less on their job titles and more on how each tour of duties, activities, and experiences prepare them for greater responsibilities in the future. This facet of the transition to larger teams can be the most difficult to manage, but it is crucial to blitzscaling success. No one likes firing employees who have been there from the beginning, but think of it this way. If your executives can't scale, your business won't scale either. The ideal solution is to retain early employees in new roles that advance their careers and help the company. But if you have to choose between losing a cherished employee and allowing him to flounder in a role for which he isn't suited, it is better to have an honest conversation and an amicable parting than it is to allow both the employee and ultimately the company to fail. Transition number 2, generalists to specialists. Another important organizational arc is moving from generalists to specialists. During the early stages of blitzscaling, the need for speed and adaptability places a hefty premium on hiring smart generalists who can get many different things done in an uncertain and rapidly changing environment. But as the company grows, it needs to shift to hiring specialists who are less fungible but have expertise in an area that is crucial to scaling the organization. This isn't to say there is no place for generalists at blitzscaling organizations. In fact, one of the main benefits of bringing on specialists is that it allows you to redeploy capable generalists to attack your most pressing challenges. For example, when LinkedIn was still in the tribe stage, one of the early employees I hired was Matt Kohler. Fresh out of McKinsey, Matt was a brilliant young man who wanted to get into the startup world. I explicitly hired him as a generalist, and once he was on board, used him as a firefighter to tackle the most urgent problems. At the time, our biggest area of need was recruiting, so Matt's first job was to lead the recruiting function. It wasn't something that his prior education or work experience had prepared him for, but I knew he was smart and scrappy, and I counted on him figuring it out. He performed admirably in that role, then moved on to tackle other fires, both for me and for Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook later on. Today, Matt is a general partner at Benchmark, a venture capital firm. Google even codified the value of generalists in its Associate Product Manager, APM, program, an initiative Marissa Mayer founded because she believed that hiring technical people straight out of college as product generalists would result in flexible, adaptable employees who could fill a lot of needs. Today, distinguished APM alumni include Quip founder and CEO and former Facebook CTO Brett Taylor, Asana co-founder Justin Rosenstein, and Optimizely co-founders Dan Soroker and Pete Kooman. Specialists also play a key role. Consider the example of Pat Waters, LinkedIn's former chief human resources officer. Pat joined us in 2013 during the city stage of our growth and helped lead us into nationhood. She recently left LinkedIn to join my friend, former eBay CEO John Donahoe, at ServiceNow, a return to the city stage. Like Matt, Pat is brilliant and talented, but she is also a specialist who has held HR roles at leading companies such as Viacom, Merck, Yahoo, and Plantronics. Running a major function for a city or nation stage company requires deep domain expertise and isn't something that a smart generalist can just figure out in a matter of weeks. While hiring specialists is an incredibly powerful tool to help you scale, it is dangerous to do so prematurely. Specialists are just that, specialized. While they are gifted and talented enough to be able to do things outside their specialty, redeploying them seldom allows them to generate anywhere near the value they can provide within their specialty. For example, I have no doubt that Pat is smart enough to learn JavaScript programming, but I would question the wisdom of John's asking her to give up her role so that she could go through a coding bootcamp and join ServiceNow's engineering team as an entry-level software engineer. It would be a criminal waste of Pat's talent and likely a bad financial move for the company. In addition, the transition that occurs when you bring in specialists to manage or replace generalists can strain the morale of the organization. Demands for functional expertise often outstrip early employees' abilities to keep up through organic learning, wrote Harvard Business School's Ranjay Gulati and Alicia DeSantola in Startups That Last, How to Scale Your Business, which appeared in the March 2016 issue of the Harvard Business Review. As a consequence, functional leadership titles increasingly go to outsiders, and the legacy folks may grow resentful. Early employees may also chafe against the narrowing confines of their changing roles. Not every generalist can or even wants to become a specialist. Often people get frustrated and leave, taking their valuable relationships and their tacit understanding of the firm's mission and culture with them. In many cases, you should work to retain your generalists, both for their cultural and institutional knowledge and for their ability to tackle new problems. But if you are unable to do so and early generalists decide to leave the organization, you should try to maintain a positive relationship with them as members of your corporate alumni network. You can read much more about this topic in our previous book, The Alliance. In the family stage, you should hire only generalists. You can certainly follow the traditional approach of recruiting from elite colleges or hiring ex-McKinsey analysts, but you should also try to focus on people with prior experience at early-stage startups who list a broad range of responsibilities and accomplishments. They may not have the pedigree, but they are great at learning new things and at charging hard to execute on them. Plus, the early business is in too much flux to effectively leverage the finely tuned capabilities of a true specialist. Even at the tribe stage, hiring a specialist should be considered a major exception. For example, if you need an engineer with a very specialized area of expertise, such as data science or machine learning. The village stage is where it becomes prudent to hire specialists, as both executives and key contributors. At the tribe stage, you want employees with skill sets flexible enough to pivot along with the company. But if you have hundreds of employees, you better have some pretty well-developed theories about your business and where it's going. Almost any executive hire at the city or nation stage is going to be a specialist. But even at these largest, latest stages, you should still mix in some number of generalists. Think of generalists as the stem cells of your organization. Your body has a small number of stem cells that have the capability to morph into various other types of cells as needed. In a large organization, you may need a small number of people who can perform various functions as needed, whether exploring new products and technologies or tackling issues that lack a well-defined solution. Transition number 3, contributors to managers to executives. The terms manager and executive are often used interchangeably. We believe that managers and executives play very different roles. Most of the confusion probably comes from the tendency in early-stage startups for the same person to play the role of manager and executive. These are separate roles, even when the same person plays them. Managers are frontline leaders who worry about day-to-day tactics. They create, implement, and execute detailed plans that allow the organization to either do new things or do existing things more efficiently. By contrast, the role of the executive is to lead managers. For the most part, executives don't manage individual contributors. Instead, they focus on vision and strategy. Yet they are still connected to the frontline employees because they are also responsible for the fighting spirit of their organizations. They need to be role models who help people persist through inevitable adversity. Both executives and managers are necessary for successful blitzscaling, but they play different roles at different stages. When a company is in the family stage, it may not need any formal managers, and even if it does, that role is generally filled by the founder CEO. As the company grows into a tribe, it will need managers to run the various functional departments, such as engineering and sales. These managers may be the founders, or they may be outside hires. Their key objective is to make a small team productive on a day-to-day basis. When the company reaches the village stage, it will need executives. It simply isn't possible to coordinate a company with hundreds of employees without executives to manage and lead multiple managers. Let's imagine a company with six departments: engineering, sales, marketing, product, support, and administration. If each department head managed 10 direct reports, and each manager reported directly to the CEO, the maximum number of employees under this executive-less arrangement would be 67, 11 in each of the six departments, plus a founder CEO. This is still small enough as to be manageable, but were the company to grow beyond that, it would become important to build in an executive layer to keep things running smoothly. A company in the village stage might have hundreds of employees. The engineering department alone would require multiple teams and team leaders who would report to a VP of engineering charged with coordinating the teams and architecting the overall organization of the department. One of the typical challenges we discussed in the section on the transition from small teams to large teams is the need to recruit executives from outside the organization. This represents a major change in approach for a company that probably promoted from within to this point, rewarding early employees who emerged as natural leaders. However, the transition from manager to executive is generally far more difficult in these organizations than that from contributor to manager. Every employee has likely reported to managers with varying styles and qualities. When promoted to a first-time manager, they can draw on these experiences to help them develop their own management style. But when an organization needs executives for the first time, internally promoted managers can't draw on the experience working with executives at that company because there weren't any. There are no role models to provide guidance. We call this situation the standard startup leadership vacuum, and the result is that inexperienced founders find themselves having to hire and integrate experienced executives from the outside. The situation is made worse when those founders wait until the strain on the organization has become unbearable before making the new hires, meaning that all the leaders are new to the company precisely at the time when tension and uncertainty are running high. The key to navigating this transition is open-mindedness. Insiders need to be open to the outside ideas of the new executives, while the outsiders need to be open to learning from what happened before they arrived. No one is born an executive, and very few make the transition from manager to executive without stumbling along the way. Hiring outside executives lets you offload that often painful and expensive education to those executives' prior employers. However, a blitzscaling organization can't simply hire anyone with executive experience at another company of similar or slightly larger size. An executive at a larger company may not have any experience with blitzscaling or even startups. Running a 100-person department at a 100-year-old company that grows at 5% a year does practically nothing to prepare you for running a 100-person department at a company that is tripling in size every year. At the same time, you don't want to hire someone whose experience with blitzscaling is at a company much larger than yours. As we'll discuss a little later, instead of hiring for the skills you think you might need in the future, you should be hiring for the skills you need right now. The ideal, of course, is to hire an executive with past experience at a blitzscaling startup that has already dealt with the challenges your company currently faces. This is why investors have more confidence in serial entrepreneurs. One of the major advantages that companies in Silicon Valley enjoy is generations of rapidly scaling companies that have produced a rich supply of executives with blitzscaling experience. Yet even if you can't land an ideal candidate, second best is to hire a manager who has previously worked with successful executives in a very rapidly growing company, or an executive who earned her executive experience at a larger or more traditional business, but who also worked at a blitzscaling startup at another time in her career. Consider the case of Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg hired Sheryl Sandberg in part because she had experienced blitzscaling as an executive, having helped her group within Google grow from a handful of people to over 4,000 employees. And one of the key things Sheryl did that helped Facebook scale up to the village, city, and nation stages was to fill critical leadership positions with other experienced scale executives, such as Mike Schrepfer as VP of Engineering and David Ebersman as CFO. Schrepp had learned how to scale engineering organizations at Mozilla, where he oversaw massive growth, and had also founded his own startup, CenterRun, before that. David had previously worked as CFO of the biotech leader Genentech and had firsthand experience with the rapid growth associated with blockbuster drugs such as Herceptin and Avastin. Martin Lau played a similar role for Pony Ma, Ma Huateng, and the rest of the founding team at Tencent. Ma and his co-founders were smart technologists but lacked business experience, especially outside China. Lau had the international business experience from his work with Goldman Sachs, but crucially, also had a strong engineering background and could relate to the team. Lau was able to bring much-needed organizational best practices to Tencent, such as revenue goals and long-term plans. This was a discipline that was urgently needed for a young company growing extremely fast, said Hans Chung, a partner at the venture capital firm GGV Capital, who co-invested with Tencent in Didi Chuxing. Another helpful strategy for hiring outside executives is to be strategic about how you blend those outside hires with inside promotions. Maryam Nafisi of the online art and graphic design marketplace Minted realized that she could combine the strengths of both groups to create a more effective management team. It takes years and years to grow candidates from within, she told our blitzscaling class at Stanford. We take disciplines where we aren't strong, like finance and HR, and hire in experts from the outside. When it comes to our secret sauce, like crowdsourcing, we grow people from the inside. Our VP Art and Stationery grew internally, while our VP Finance and Chief People Officer are outside hires. Even if an outside executive has the requisite blitzscaling experience, though, he or she could still fail because of poor cultural fit, the transplant rejection phenomenon. When hiring an executive from another company, there are things you can and should take into account to help ensure the graft takes to the host culture. One master of these techniques is John Lilly, a venture capitalist at Greylock Partners and the former CEO of Mozilla. When he was CEO at Mozilla, John oversaw incredibly rapid growth. During his first 6 months at the organization, the number of employees tripled. Given Mozilla's small initial size, this growth necessitated hiring executives from the outside, the graft, which was particularly challenging because of the company's strong engineering-driven culture, the host, that was already skeptical about outsiders. John was able to do this successfully by following the same three-step process that was used to hire him. 1. Hire someone who is already a known quantity to at least one member of the team. John was hired by Mitchell Baker, his predecessor as CEO of Mozilla. The two had gotten to know each other by serving on a board together, and Mitchell's personal endorsement of John carried weight with the team at Mozilla. Similarly, John had known Schrepp at Stanford and worked with him at John's own startup, Reactivity, before he hired Schrepp at Mozilla. 2. Bring the new executive in at a lower level initially and let the executive prove himself or herself. John gave himself the title Director of Business Development and Operations and only took on bigger titles after he had demonstrated his ability and value to existing teams. He employed the same technique when he hired Schrepp, bringing him in as Director of Engineering. Once Schrepp had a chance to prove himself, John noted, it became pretty clear to everyone pretty quickly that Schrepp was incredibly confident and improved everything he touched. This visible success made promoting him to VP of Engineering both obvious and uncontroversial. 3. Once the executive has earned the team's trust and credibility, consider promoting him or her. Another executive that John hired, Dan Portillo, was brought in to run recruiting, but proved so valuable that he is promoted to VP of People and asked to run HR as well. Today, Dan serves in a similar role at Greylock. As your company progresses from a village to a city or even a nation, you'll continue to need to hire executives, both because the growth in size will require you to add layers above your frontline managers, and because your executives won't always have what it takes to scale to the next stage. But once your organization has successful executives who can serve as role models and mentors, you will be able to start promoting promising managers with personal experience working with those successful executives from within. When Facebook was growing, it was critically important to bring in experienced executives like Sheryl Sandberg, but almost all of Facebook's key product leaders today were trained internally. While entrepreneurs often resist creating a hierarchy by classifying their people into executives, managers, and contributors, this kind of formal structure is essential to growth, according to Ranjay Gulati and Alicia DeSantola, who wrote in Harvard Business Review in 2016, "When launching their startups, many founders eschew hierarchy because of their egalitarian ideals. But as their firms scale, a growing number of people report to a handful of leaders. Founders may think this allows them to remain in command because all decisions pass through them. But ironically, their organizations spin out of control as centralized authority becomes a bottleneck that hinders information flow, decision-making, and execution. A couple of people at the top can't effectively supervise everyone's increasingly specialized day-to-day work. In such a system, accountability for organizational goals gets lost." Gulati and DeSantola cite the example of Cloudflare, whose founders publicly committed to building a completely flat organization without hierarchy or job titles. While the founders made this decision for a commendable reason, CEO Matthew Prince felt that eliminating job titles would prevent early employees from feeling demoted if the company later hired more experienced people. The results, as documented in a Harvard Business School case study by Tom Eisenman and Alex Godden, were poor. In the 3 months ending in July 2012, 5 of the firm's 35 employees quit, some citing the lack of a clear mid-level reporting structure and the non-existent HR practices. They described situations in which they had no one to turn to, short of pestering the founders, if they thought certain practices such as activities relating to software or coding standards needed to change. Blitzscaling organizations need organization, not just to coordinate their many resources and activities, but in order to maximize speed. The organization's collective learning rate, especially within its leadership team, determines its ability to anticipate future trends, while the strength of its internal structure, especially in terms of its frontline teams, determines its ability to act quickly on those key insights and seize the competitive advantage. Transition number 4. Dialogue to broadcasting. One area that undergoes the most change during blitzscaling is the internal communications process. As the company grows, you have to shift from informal, in-person, individual conversations to formal, electronic, push broadcasting, and online pull resources. You also have to shift from sharing all information by default to deciding on what is secret and what is shareable. If you don't manage to develop an effective internal communication strategy, your organization will become disjointed and start to fall apart. In the family stage, the entire organization is typically under the same roof, possibly even all working in the same room. As a result, information spreads quite naturally without any additional intervention, possibly more than you'd like. When you have a question or need feedback, you can simply pop up from your chair, or balancing ball, or treadmill desk and say, "Hey, does anyone know?" This prairie dog style of communication is organic, quick, and effective. Everyone is still working on the same initiative, so the interruption is likely relevant and/or productive, or easily ignored by wearing headphones if necessary. The biggest challenge you likely face at this stage is keeping the rare virtual employee in the loop. Because it is so easy for the rest of the team to communicate with one another, you have to make an effort to constantly communicate with any remote members to keep them on the same page as the rest of the team. Communications tools like Slack not only provide a medium where all teammates participate on the same terms, but also allow for asynchronous communication, which helps overcome time zone differences. Another approach some companies take is to set up a 24/7 video conferencing using tools like Skype or Google Hangouts to simulate being in the same room. These informal bonds remain a critical part of the communications process, even as your firm grows into a global giant. Human beings are social animals, and the bonds between coworkers and teammates require regular dialogue. However, as early as the tribe stage, you will need to begin implementing processes to supplement the one-to-one dialogue. For example, nearly every tribe-sized startup holds a weekly company meeting, though with wildly varying degrees of effectiveness. The weekly meeting is most effective when it serves as a mechanism to bring together the entire company and for company leaders to convey key messages to employees with whom they don't work directly. A tribal meeting should be well organized, with an agenda and other materials provided in advance so that participants can engage in an interactive discussion rather than simply listening to senior leaders talking or, worse, suffer through text-dense PowerPoint presentations. The goal shouldn't be to make decisions in these meetings unless the topic is one in which everyone can and should have input, like where to hold the holiday party. Rather, it's to maximize input from smart people and make sure that everyone feels heard. As a leader, you should seek out opinions from across the organization on important issues, but you can't abdicate your responsibility and rely only on group consensus to make tough decisions. The best tribal meetings include rituals that go beyond the cut-and-dried business of the company and help the employees get to know one another better as people, not just workers. For example, one rapidly growing startup that Chris was involved with reserved a portion of each company meeting for one employee to give a get-to-know-me presentation. This allowed everyone to get to know the new kid on the block on a level well beyond the typical welcome email. Obviously, this is the kind of activity that only works at the tribe stage. In a family, it isn't necessary, and a larger company would never have time to introduce every employee in this fashion. When a company grows to the village stage, simple logistics can make it difficult to hold a company meeting, often called an all-hands meeting. Even if the company hasn't already grown to the point where it occupies multiple offices, it may be difficult to find a physical space where hundreds of employees can gather. Renting an off-site auditorium for a weekly company meeting is both expensive and impractical. The right thing is generally to shift the cadence of such meetings to a lower frequency, such as monthly or quarterly, and to leverage technology like video conferencing to bring the various offices together. One interesting approach is to have all employees use a teleconferencing service rather than allow headquarters employees to have a better in-person experience than the rest of the company. For example, at the asset management company BlackRock, certain meetings are held by teleconference, even for the subset of employees who could gather in a single conference room, so that all employees are on an equal footing. With technology eliminating the logistical challenges, the company all hands is highly scalable. These broadcast techniques can work for organizations even as they scale through the city and nation stages. At LinkedIn, you could trace the growth of the company over time by observing its all-hands meetings. As the business grew, these meetings moved from the company cafeteria to an auditorium, and today they involve live video broadcasts across the globe. The all-hands needs to have a formal questions period so that employees can request needed information and feel part of the decision-making process. At LinkedIn, we have moderators in each office gather questions for management. It's also at this point that the founder CEO needs to make a conscious effort to develop broadcast channels to reach far-flung employees who might not otherwise feel a personal connection with the company's leader. Of course, at the village stage, the company likely exceeds Dunbar's number, the number of individuals with whom any one person can maintain stable relationships, and the founder simply won't have time to meet one-on-one with every employee with any reasonable frequency. For example, even if you made time in your schedule for 2 one-to-one employee meetings each day and spent time in every one of the company's offices, you would still only touch each member of a 500-person company once every 8 months, not enough to build a strong relationship. Switching to one-to-many communications doesn't always feel comfortable for founders and CEOs. Patrick Collison, the co-founder and CEO of the fast-growing payment company Stripe, described how he overcame these feelings when he visited our blitzscaling class at Stanford. The big change is the need for formal, explicit broadcast communication. It feels unnatural, especially for me for some reason. Part of the way to rationalize it is to realize that a startup is not a natural environment. The optimal things to do don't always feel natural. The social groups you belong to don't typically grow 100% per year. The new people weren't there for all the tortured discussions of the past. That can be good, but they also don't have the context, so it is a delicate balancing act. Brian Chesky addresses this need at Airbnb by sending a long email to every employee each Sunday night. Chesky's email isn't simply a recitation of key performance indicators, which could just as easily be accessed on a dashboard somewhere. Rather, Chesky shares his thinking on a topic he considers important to the company. This broadcast communication's length, specificity, and authenticity Transmit to every Airbnb employee an understanding of who Chesky is and what matters to him. Regular emails to all employees are a common best practice. Blitzscaling masters Patrick Collison and YouTube's Shashir Mehrotra also employed this technique to manage their rapidly growing organizations. I was a big believer in writing a weekly email, Shashir told our Blitzscaling class at Stanford. Leaders who write things down tend to deal with fewer communications issues. You have to clarify your thought processes in a completely different way,